We get a little noisy when we start judging. For example, I'll give you a simple, down-to-earth example. You're driving along very nicely, and somebody comes and cuts you off, and then gives you one of those not-too-pleasant hand signals. Now, immediately, you say, what a jerk. How rude. And you start judging the entire situation, and you start getting upset. And then you get to the office, wherever you're going. Let's say it's an office, your workplace. And you get in there, and one of your coworkers say, what's the matter with you? And you start saying, you wouldn't believe how people are rude. Here's what this guy did to me this morning. He just cut me off, and then he showed me that obscene signal, and then he kept going. You know what should happen to people like that? See how noisy you've become? Here's another way. Tell me which is more creative. Here's another way. Simple. After the guy passes you and he does that, nothing has changed with you except some person decided to break the rules of the road and cut in front of you because he wanted to get there faster. Your thought should be, oops. Tap on your brakes a little and say to yourself, hey, buddy, the best place for you is far, far away from me. And you arrive at work undisturbed by it. You don't even remember it. The first way, the guy probably didn't even notice that he did this to you. It affected you half the day. You took it to the office with you. The second way, which is much better, is you dismissed it. You didn't even judge it. And sometimes there's an irony to it. I remember one in which this guy was just weaving in and out, and I thought, huh, well, let me just stay out of his way and wish him well. And it was just, I wished him so much good times that about a mile or two later, I saw these flashing lights behind his car, which was parked at the side, and these wonderful people in uniform were just giving him a ticket for speeding. And I thought, look at that. He was rushing to save 2 minutes. Now he's delayed for half an hour. So these laws, these things that we talk about have such practical application. And there is no beginning and ending of one law or the other. Like, you know, they all roll into the other. In physics, we have what we call the study of electricity and the study of magnetism. And you might say, well, where does one begin and one end? It doesn't, because you create electricity by using a magnet in something that we call a dynamo or whatever it is they call it, that spins a certain way against the north and south pole, and then there's a flow of electrons. So which one is which? Magnetic things, magnetism, or electricity? In water, we have hydrostatics and mechanics, and heat, light, and sound. They all are related to each other. So the law of attraction related to the law of gravity, related to the law of solitude and silence. By the way, when I speak of silence and solitude, I'm talking about sometimes aloneness, which is totally, totally different from what people call loneliness. I have been alone many times. I have experienced aloneness quite a lot, and solitude by choice, but hardly ever have I been lonely. And I think people can get to that point. It's some of those, some of the equipment we came here with. But I'm sure, Steve, you've heard people say that we only use about 10% of our brain.
Yes.
Okay. Imagine what it'll be like if we used maybe 20%. 50%? It's there. Why did we get it in the first place? Since I assume that whoever our creator is, in whatever language or religion, the creator's got to be so powerful. Why would we have this if there was no purpose to it? It's that we don't practice using more. Deepak once was telling me of a funny thing, and I cracked up. He said, you know, John, every day, and I don't know, he said he didn't know either, where they get this data from, but I think it's a statistical study and a mathematical study that gave them this. So every day we think approximately 60,000 to 100,000 thoughts. At first I was amused because I didn't think we thought that many thoughts. That sounds funny. I didn't think we thought that many thoughts a day. And he says, yeah, 60 to 100,000. I said, wow. He says, well, that's not the amazing thing. Guess what? The problem with the whole thing is we think that many thoughts we today. Tomorrow, we think 90% of the thoughts we are thinking are the same ones we were thinking today, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And I said, oh yeah, isn't that so? How many times I think this thing now, and 2 hours later I think it again, and then the next day we're thinking the same thing. It doesn't give the equipment within us time and space, and I put those in quotes, time-space, if you will, time-space, to really get into other things and expand other things, to create new neural pathways in our minds, to think new things. Here's a very simple thing that I used with, and it all has to do with what we're talking about, everything being tied into everything, and the cloak of invisibility also part of it. But I had an old aunt who was losing her memory, and she didn't know what to do, and nobody knew that it wasn't Alzheimer's, but it was age or something. And she says, do you have, by the way, some members of my family thought or still think I know everything, and I don't try to convince them otherwise because it's more difficult to do that than to let them think I do. So she says, well, can you tell me some things to do that would keep my memory a little bit active and I won't forget that much? I said, use your brain. She said, how? I said, well, read to yourself aloud. She said, oh, I like to read. I'll do that. I said, you will be using different parts of your being. I said, here's another one. Do your times table in your head. I said, I don't forget a lot, or I never used to. Now I do. I said, but I could repeat the 13 times table, like 13 times 1 is 13, 13 times 2, 26, 13 times 3, 39, and you could go 4 is 52, and on and on and on. I said, what it does, it forces your mind. It forces your brain. It forces it to create new neural pathways. The firing of those little things in there increase because when you put a demand on it, it gives you the supply. It's like if you have muscles, ask some of her friends in the bodybuilding business, John Benson, Tom Venuto, and all these wonderful people. How do they get their muscles to be that? They exercise. They do certain things. So we can exercise ourselves, exercise our ability to see things in our mind, to be quiet, to use the cloak of invisibility, to break any habit or most of them. Now, I'm not saying we're going to be perfect. We can even practice to walk on water. I've seen people do that. I bet a lot of people here might have heard of people walking on fire, and I've seen them do fire walking also, but I've met very, very few who would walk on water. Guess what? It's the same principle, but the belief comes in that, yeah, you know, a lot of people can walk on fire, then why can't they walk on water? Because they don't believe it.
I see how belief ties into a lot of things we do. As a hypnotherapist, I'm constantly reminded of just how much we can do with belief in ourselves and what we're doing and how little we can do without it. So I appreciate you making that very clear, John, and really driving that point home.
Well, I'm glad because I didn't want anybody to think, anybody who is listening to this or who will be listening to it eventually, I don't want anyone to think that there are really walls between these powers, if you will, or these abilities. I don't want them to think that, well, okay, the law of attraction ends here and the law of meditation starts there. Because then we'll walk around and say, okay, I got a problem. Let me see what I need to use to get it done. And you reach into your little bag of powers and you say, oh, here we got the law of gravity. No, 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 not that one. How about the law of attraction? No, not that one. How about the law of this or the law of that? Maybe one of these will. No, I didn't want people to think that way. I want them to know there's really just one law, the law of the universe and all the other laws. Everyone else is a part of this whole thing. So if you use one, if you use a part, you use the whole. And a good example would be the human body. What would it be like if your middle finger says, you know, I don't want to be the middle finger. I'm not a part of this body. I want to be the little finger. And the little finger says, you know, I prefer to be a nose. And if we had that happening, the entire organism would destroy itself. But each one depends on all the others. And I don't walk around and say, hey, this is my hand. My hand is happy to meet you. No, I, John, am happy to meet you. But the John, of course, has a hand. He is not the hand, but he has one. He has a head. He has eyes. He has feet. He has a voice, but he is not his voice. Here we take a little step. I hope people get this. He has thoughts, but he is not his thoughts. He only thinks them. He has a mind, but he is not his mind. He only has it. The question comes up when we follow that logic to the end. You say, then who is John, if he's not his finger, it's not his head, it's not his nose, it's not his mind, it's not his brain? The answer is very simple. He is all of these. He is this, that, and the other, not this or that or the other. And that's how the rishis, the ancient rishis, looked at this. That's how they developed the things they developed. That's how the Shambhala masters, the Shaolin masters, the yogi masters deal with the world, as if the world is a giant gift given to us to do what we want with it within the laws of, let's say, nature, which we can transcend if we knew what they are. Remember what I said earlier? You can break the rules, but before you do, please know what they are.
Very well put, John. Very well put. You know, John, the more I think about it, the more I realize that the cloak of invisibility is apparently just part of what we do and part of who we are as humans. What do you think about that concept?
It's no different than, as humans, we breathe air. And it's such an integral part of us that we don't even notice it. We breathe air, we eat food, we drink water, we walk, we talk. All these are parts of the human being. But there are so many more. And the cloak of invisibility is a part of all of this. And I always try to stay away from what people would think are extraordinary things. Extraordinary and ordinary and so forth, because everything is simple and ordinary. They're only extraordinary when we don't understand them. Again, I think some of you might have read in Richard Bach's book, The Illusions, where he said, know what the magician knows, and it's not magic anymore. And that is so true. 1,000 years ago, the knowledge for making airplanes existed, but nobody had an airplane. It was left for it to the ideas to come and put together the Wright brothers and whatnot, and then the little flimsy airplane they made that flew for a few seconds or minutes, and then from that to look at what we've got today. Were these newly created ideas? My thought and the thoughts of a lot of people in the field are simple where this is concerned. These laws exist. We haven't gotten to the state of consciousness yet where we could think of them. But again, the electricity existed way, way, way before we knew. Even in the caveman days, there was electricity and thunderstorms, thunderclouds. But over the years, because people tuned into the cosmos and tuned into the connection to the cosmos, which is their brain, as a matter of fact, that giant computer in the sky, which we tap, the keyboard is our brain, we tap into it, and then here we got electricity that lights our homes, runs our businesses, works the computer. So all these things are tied together. And if I leave nothing else but this, remember, it's not a divided thing. It's a united thing. We're all one. The laws are all one. We can even talk about the law of one and split it into any law we want. We can talk of the body as the law of one, that's the body, and split it into the law of the finger, the law of the nose, the law of the eyes, and so forth. Does that answer in any degree your question, Steve? I think it should.
Absolutely. That definitely sheds light on that. I appreciate that. And so it does all tie together. John, do you feel that, you know, looking beyond this, and I know we're talking about the cloak of invisibility and the power of silence, I know you have a strong interest in the work of Albert Einstein, and I know that Einstein had a strong interest in the unified field theory, just thinking of a theory that would tie in everything together. Now we have string theory, super string theory, etc. But at his time, he was very interested in tying everything together, and that seems to be an ongoing concept in physics. And I'm bringing this up because I'm seeing here some little glimmers of possibly shades of physics as well, and maybe a unified field theory. Can you speak to that a little bit?
I'm glad you brought that up, one of my favorite topics. And I think at the highest levels of studies that chemistry, physics, mathematics, spirituality are all one, because things seem to behave the same in one or the other studies. For example, when I was one of the advanced courses in chemistry was called physical chemistry. Another course in physics was called chemical physics. There's nuclear physics, nuclear chemistry. I had to take some of these things. And they're very interesting. But I have watched the search for the unified theory forever. And if I were to make a prediction, I think we will be searching for the unified theory forever. Now, you might say, why do you say that? They thought they came up with it. Yeah, I know about what they call the weak force and the strong force and the electromagnetic force and all these different things. And these are the only few forces there are. But every time we find something, and even Einstein talked about that, every time we find something and we think we've got it and we say, oh, by Jove, I've got it. It eludes us, and we find that there's more. It's like walking along looking for the horizon. As we move, it moves. I think in a very creative universe, we're not going to be able to do that because we are all explorers. Now, that doesn't mean we are not going to be able to detect and develop other things that use these the laws that we aren't going to discover in this time-space situation. I think there will be cars one day that fly. I think there will be cars one day that you press a button and it becomes invisible. I think there'll be a lot of things, but way, way out there, I think no matter how much we look, and this again, by the way, this is my personal feeling based on the meditations and the studies I have done and the readings. This is my opinion that, go ahead, search for the unified theory, the law of one. And every time you think you come next to it, you'll find something else. I told you for the longest time, I think I said this before, we thought, you know, light travels the fastest of any quote-unquote thing we know. It travels in a straight line, and it travels the fastest, 186,000 miles per second. Think of how far it'll go in a day. It is so fast, and spaces between star systems are so vast that we measure the space not in miles or meters or kilometers, but in light years, which is one light year is actually the distance that light will travel in 1 year at the speed of approximately 186,000 miles per second. Now we're knowing a few other things about light. We thought it traveled in a straight line, but we're discovering that light could be curved. We thought that the fastest speed is the speed of light. Even Einstein thought about that, and he did what he called his thought experiments. And then we discovered that, there are certain particles called tachyons or tachyons, T-A-C-H-Y-O-N-S, that seem to travel a few times faster than the speed of light. Now, after that, I'm sure a generation from now, they'll discover something that would travel at 20 times the speed. And every time you discover a subatomic particle, you find later on that there are a few others you didn't know existed. So there are hundreds of subatomic particles. That means things that are smaller than electrons and protons. And now they split these things and find all kinds of stuff. So it is a magical, mysterious, simple, complex universe, if I'm to use all those words. And again, going back to the unified field theory, I don't know. I just think we are having enough fun discovering things right now. If we don't think so, take a look at your computer. Take a look at the technology in which we're talking right now, Steve. I mean, a few years ago, we couldn't do that. We had to do it through a telephone and a landline and all kinds of stuff. And we certainly wouldn't have had the ability to record it properly. But look at that. Look at the things that are happening right now. And we're advancing. We're advancing very quickly. And my only prayer and my only hope is that we gather more wisdom than knowledge, or that our knowledge, our wisdom keeps pace with knowledge. And for those who don't know the difference, knowledge is just a conglomeration of facts. Wisdom is putting those facts together in such a way that they become helpful. Therefore, knowledge is a storehouse. Wisdom is a powerhouse. This says a lot of religions, a lot of philosophies say that.
John, I appreciate that, and that really sums it up for me. You know, one of the things that I'm wondering is, you mentioned that the ancient rishis and gurus were aware of this power of the cloak of invisibility and the power of silence. How were they using it?
They use it to have fun with each other, meeting each other. For example, I read there's some books written by the late Harold Sherman, and in one of them I remember where someone from South America would all of a sudden appear with his friend on a bench by the beach in Long Island. They'd talk for an hour or two, and then he'd go back to South America. Now, you could actually, from what I understand, this isn't my first-hand experience. I hadn't seen that thing what he wrote about there, but these people could travel great distances in the twinkling of an eye. Shirley MacLaine, in her book, I think it was, I don't remember the name of it, but one of her first books about this topic mentioned that in, maybe it was Tibet, she saw a few of these monks, these Buddhist monks, move by like a flash of light, a few of them walking barefoot in the snow and not bothering about it. How do they use it? Take, for example, Deepak talked of his father who went to the Himalayas and found a cave where there was this special yogi, and the yogi had a few little scars on his arms, and there were all kinds of cobras around, and the little group turned to the yogi and said, but don't you have, you were bitten by snakes and you didn't die. And he says, oh no, the snakes are my friends. They can't hurt me. Oh, yeah, there are little scars here and there, but that was nothing. Then there's story told, I think it was either Yogananda. Some people listening may have read autobiography of a yogi by Swami Yogananda. I never met him. I knew two of his direct disciples personally, but I never met the great Yogananda. And if he didn't tell the story, then somebody else did, where I read it, I don't remember. About there was this giant celebration on the banks of the Ganges, and there were hundreds of thousands of people and all these little tents, and all of a sudden a fire started rushing through the crowd, consuming the tents and everything else. And there was this holy man in this one tent, and they ran to him and said, come on, Swamiji, Guruji, get out of here, the fire is coming. And he smiled and he looked at the fire, and the fire came, parted in two. One went to the left side and the other to the right, and then joined back again. And everything was, all the tents were destroyed. Nobody got killed, but the Swami's tent was untouched. And when asked about it, he said, you know, there was no problem, no magic. The fire is my friend. It will not harm me. For that moment, I became one with it. Notice we're coming back to this word one. And since you like Richard Bach's books also, you might have read the book he called One, where he says, how many lives in the universe? One. How many universes? A gazillion or one. No matter how we count it, we come back to the word, to the number one. All numbers in the world, in the universe, are made up by multiples of the number one. You name any number, and I can name you a number larger than that by adding one to it. So one is a magical, mystical number.
John, that's wonderful. And I actually have read that book a few years back, One by Richard Bach. Great book. And I appreciate you enlightening us using the information from that and so many other sources that you're able to draw on. It's one of the great things about you. You're so versatile. You've got so much knowledge and wisdom, and you weave it together so nicely. So I appreciate that. Now, John, you told me that we were going to talk about how to stay sane in an insane world. Now, I want you to elaborate on that. How, first of all, is this world insane, and how are we combating that with this technology and staying sane?
Okay, first of all, it was just a, let's call it almost a thoughtless statement, because the world certainly isn't insane. It's the inhabitants of the world that could be insane. So for short, I say, you know, it's an insane world. But the reason it's like that is we are buying into the insanity of others. And every time we do that, we make them stronger. You know, Gandhi once said something that I like very much. He says, if we use the old law of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, then half the world, everybody would be blind. And I thought, how does that affect me? But it's just a way of saying, when I react to something, the world or that thing reacts to me. When I respond to that thing responds to me in kind, which means if I carry thoughts of peace, I don't have to go around saying, I'm a peaceful guy and we all should be peaceful. That is just like gargling, like just saying something and meaning nothing. But if we go around with a heart of peace, yeah, we might get into trouble. You might be injured, but it's a chance you take because you know that it's only a game. We're all playing game. Some of us are playing cops, some are playing robbers, and we think it's real. And it doesn't matter what we're playing, we don't get harmed with it. But we think we are, and as we do, it feels real. So when I talk about an insane world, I'm talking about a noisy world. People are so busy talking to themselves or talking about their opinions to others, but that they never have a chance to get quiet and let sanity return, because our normal state is sanity. The world, with all its seeming imperfections, is actually perfect. If you don't think so, think of a simple thing as a leaf. Can we make one of those? Think of something as simple as an egg. Can we make one of those? Our scientists are trying to make all kinds of things. They've been able to clone sheep, do all kinds of things, transplants of all kinds. But can we make the basis of it? What makes these things? And if we break them down into the building blocks, we discover that there are other building blocks that make up the building blocks themselves. So if we quiet, to make a long story short, a short answer to the long one I've been giving, to quiet the insane world, quiet your thoughts.
Wow, very powerfully put, John, and I appreciate that. I appreciate the sentiment there. I appreciate, again, the knowledge, the wisdom, the experience that you bring to the table, and that you're allowing us to share with you. So thank you for that, and thank you for enlightening us about the cloak of invisibility and the power of silence, and I now have some new skills that I'm anxious to try out.
Well, it was great doing this. I really enjoy it. I always enjoy these conversations.
Well, thank you. And on behalf of myself, Steve G. Jones, and my good friend here, John Harry Turan, we want to wish you an outstanding life.